Hi, welcome everyone. It's good to see you here. It's great to see everyone here. I'm Deborah Margolis. I'm the librarian who works with the Muslim Studies program. I also work with the Jewish Studies program, the Anthropology department. And welcome to the second meeting of the Muslim Journeys Book Club for this academic year. In the fall, we read Thomas Jefferson's Quran, Islam and the Founders, and tonight we're going to go back even further in Muslim American history with the Moore's account. This Muslim Journeys program was originally funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, but in the past 2 years here at MSU and in partnership with community organizations like the Interfaith Clergy Association of Greater Lansing and the Islamic Society of Greater Lansing, we've continued the programming. And I think in the years ahead, we're going to have to turn to each other even more. I'm going to skip over a little bit, but thank you so much for being here tonight to learn about our country's history and about each other and from each other. This book club is going to meet about every 2 weeks until March 15th, with the next meeting being on February 8th, where we'll read the autobiography of Malcolm X, which I have here. This is my copy. And we're really excited to read that and discuss it. Austin Jackson, a professor in the Residential College of Arts and Humanities, is going to be leading that discussion. Thank you so much to the MSU Muslim Studies program, its director, Muhammad Khalil, and to the MSU libraries, particularly shout out to our diversity committee in the library. Sharon Ladenson is here helping me out and helping promote diversity at MSU and library. And thanks to Mike from the Digital Media Center for the great help with the audio visual. Here is the order of the evening. So first we're gonna have about a half hour lecture, and then we're gonna break into three different discussion groups at the three tables in the back, and we'll help you get there. And we'll spend about 45 minutes in those groups, and those groups are gonna be led by three fantastic graduate students here at MSU, Allison Kaledzi from History, and Jill Mansky from Education, and Jessica Kane from English. So thank you guys so much for helping with this programming. And after the discussion groups, we'll reconvene over here and we'll kind of report out from the groups a little bit and hear from our presenter and have an opportunity to ask questions. So instrumental in planning this year's series was tonight's presenter, Leila Tarakchi. She was a very popular presenter in our last year's series, so we're so happy to have her back. And this year's series, focusing on Muslim American literature, that's her field here in the Department of English as a PhD candidate. Her research is committed towards the development of Muslim American literature studies and its role within a broader field of ethnic literary studies. She's especially interested in self-representations and in the diverse discourses expressed by Muslim Americans. So we welcome Leila. Thank you.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for having me. Before we start talking about the Moore's account and kind of the source history that I'm kind of looking back at, I just wanted to ask you, because a lot of people are surprised when they learn about, you know, that a lot of the African slaves who were, Africans who were brought here and enslaved, that a lot of them were Muslim. So just kind of as a kind of a question to ask the audience, can anybody kind of throw out a guess of, or does anybody know what percentage of the African slaves were Muslim? And there's a range of theories anyway, so you'll likely be right. 60%. 60, a little less.
30.
Yeah, so they say anywhere as little as 5%, but a lot of guesses range between 15 and 30%. Yeah, so up to 30%. So that's quite a lot. Another question is, does anybody know where Azamor is? Like, what is the modern day Azamor, where Mustafa is from? Algeria, good. Yeah, it's kind of like the west side of Morocco. So, you'll notice that the author never actually says Morocco because there was no Morocco back then. All right, so let's get started. So while the number of Muslim slaves in America remains unknown, with estimates ranging between 5 and 30% of all slaves, what we do know is that there were hundreds of thousands of Muslims in the Americas. Various accounts by the slaves themselves and by others offer us glimpses of their lives and histories, as well as the cultures and traditions they carried with them across the Atlantic. In many ways, Layla Al-Alami's The Moors Account fills in the gaps for the few slave writings we have and for those we don't, for the thousands of Muslim slaves we know were brought to the Americas. The Moors Account is the imagined memoir of Mustafa ibn Muhammad ibn Abdussalam al-Zamuri, whom history recognizes by his enslaved name Estebanico. As Mustafa tells us about the trials of his expedition to Florida, his account is interspersed with stories about his family and his childhood in Azamor. The events that lead him to selling himself into slavery to feed his family, his ensuing captivity, and how he became the first black explorer of the Americas. He sails to America as the slave of a Spanish conquistador and soon becomes one of only four survivors of the 1527 Spanish expedition to the New World led by Pamphilo de Narvaez. The most famous survivor of this expedition is Alvar Nunez Cabeza de Vaca, whose account of his time among the native peoples of the areas remains one of the few surviving records of that region, before its inhabitants were exterminated and displaced. In her acknowledgments, Al-Alami notes that while her novel is based on actual events, it is fictional. And she says, "This is especially true of my protagonist, about whose background nothing is known, except for one line in Cabeza de Vaca's account, which states, the fourth survivor is Estebanico, an Arab Negro from Azamor." So that's kind of sums up what history has documented about Estebanico. The Moors account allows us to imagine the struggles, reactions, and sentiments of Estebanico and other African slaves who are in similar positions, as it mirrors various aspects and tropes of the earlier non-fictional Muslim slave writings. The text thus offers an opportunity to explore the centuries-old history of Muslims in America. What I would like to do today is draw parallels between this fictional memoir and early African Muslim slave writings. In particular, I hope to explore how the Moors account calls forth themes of language, literacy, and faith that are especially relevant in early Muslim slave writings. The text also highlights a powerful impetus for behind the slave writing genre in general, that is the need to reaffirm one's history and culture and to pass on one's story so that it may be remembered. So I'd like to read a passage from the Moors account, and it's the introductory passage on the first page, really, and so I'm just going to read the first section and kind of jump around a little bit. So he says, "In the name of God, most compassionate, most merciful, praise be to God, the Lord of the worlds, and prayers and blessings be on our Prophet Muhammad and upon all his progeny and companions. This book is the humble work of Mustafa ibn Muhammad ibn Abdussalam al-Zamuri, being a true account of his life and travels from the city of Azamur to the land of the Indians, where he arrived as a slave and in his attempt to return to freedom was shipwrecked and lost for many years. Because I have written this narrative long after the events I recount took place, I have had to rely entirely on my memory." Then he continues, "I intend to correct details of the history that was compiled by my companions, the three Castilian gentlemen known by the names of Andre Durantes de Carranza, Alonso del Castillo Maldonado, and especially Alvar Nunez Cabeza de Vaca, who delivered their testimony, what they called the joint report, to the Audiencia of Santo Domingo. The first was my legal master, the second my fellow captive, and the third my rival storyteller. But unlike them, I was never called upon to testify to the Spanish viceroy about our journey among the Indians." And then a little further down, he says that he intends to correct some of the things that they said in their testimony, saying that I, who am neither beholden to Castilian men of power, nor bound by the rules of a society to which I do not belong, feel free to recount the true story of what happened to my companions and me. What each of us wants in the end, whether he is black or white, master or slave, rich or poor, man or woman, is to be remembered after his death. I am no different. I want to survive the eternity of darkness that awaits me." And I'll stop there. In this introductory statement, he outlines the purpose of his account and his and he identifies himself as its true author. In a lot of ways, this introduction is very, I felt like echoes a lot of classical, like introductions to other earlier slave writings. And it's in the way that he introduces himself as the author and his history and his journey and his captivity. In doing so, he claims ownership of the text and agency in writing it. After representing himself as a Muslim via the Basmala and his praising of Prophet Muhammad, he introduces himself, his lineage, as the son of Muhammad, son of Abdus-Salam, and his homeland of Az-Zamur, Al-Zamuri. Thus, he establishes his roots within a religious and spiritual tradition, a family history, and a geographical and cultural homeland. We see a similar beginning in the autobiography of Umar ibn Sa'id, who's pictured here, penned by his own hand in 1831, Umar ibn Sa'id's The Life of Umar ibn Sa'id is critical in that it provides us with the only extant autobiography written in Arabic by a slave in the United States. Born and educated in a region called Futaturo, Umar was an Islamic scholar in West Africa before he was captured and sent to Charleston, South Carolina in 1807. After 2 years, he escaped harsh conditions only to be recaptured and imprisoned in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where he filled his jail cell with Arabic writings that drew the attention of locals and in particular that of his future owner, James Owen. Although Umar's literacy in Arabic earned him a certain level of fame and respect, he would remain a slave until the time of his death in 1863. Both Mustafa, or Estebanico, and Umar ibn Sa'id begin their text with the invocation, "In the name of Allah, most compassionate, most merciful," also known as the Basmala. In doing so, they situate their text within the genre of Muslim slave writings and within the Islamic tradition more broadly. Ronald Judy describes the symbolic significance of this traditional invocation, saying, "The Basmala, in the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, as the epigraph of all texts, is the reading of the text of Islam by the text of Islam. Hence, the Quran is the text of Islam, which prescribes that all texts of Islam are readings of it. By beginning with the Basmala, the manuscript to which he refers, the Ben Ali manuscript, places itself in a long line with those other Islamic texts that are readings of this first text." So according to Judy, Umar's use of the Basmala situates his autobiography within a long line of Islamic texts that can only be read and understood within the context of Islam via the primary text of Islam, namely the Quran. This invocation positions the writer and his writing within a long and rich tradition of Islamic scholarship. It resists the displacement and precarious situation of enslavement by rooting him within an Islamic tradition that spans people and places around the world as well as centuries, extending back to prophetic revelation. For both Mustafa and Umar, especially Umar, who was an educated and well-respected Islamic scholar in West Africa, this is particularly significant as it reasserts critical links to their past, their homeland, their educated background, and religious and cultural origins. These links to literacy, education, and Islam are explicitly stated in Umar's opening lines, where he says, "My name is Umar ibn Sa'id. My birthplace is Futur, between the two rivers. I sought knowledge in Bundu and Futa with a sheikh called Muhammad Sa'id, my brother, and Sheikh Sulaiman Kimba and Sheikh Jibril Abdul. I continued seeking knowledge for 25 years, then I came to my place and stayed for 6 years. Then there came to our country a big army, it killed many people. It took me and walked me to the big sea and sold me into the hand of a Christian man." Immediately, after informing his readers of his name and birthplace, Umar continues to identify himself by detailing the history of his educational journey. Although a Western audience would not be familiar with the names of his teachers, he makes it a point to mention their full names. This suggests that he might be addressing a West African and/or Muslim audience that is familiar with them. So in this way, he's writing to a familiar audience. It also demonstrates the extent of his knowledge, having studied at the hands of three distinct scholars and for 25 years. We see more extensive traces of this in the Moor's account, as Mustafa writes about his schooling, highlighting his literacy and the power of storytelling. Sylvian Diouf in The Servants of Allah notes that this focus on literacy and education is characteristic of Muslim slave narratives. It served to establish from the beginning of the text that, quote, they were brought up as Muslims and had studied for a long time, that they were men of faith and accomplishments, who had not always been mere beasts of burden, but intellectuals who had suffered a terrible reversal of fortune. Again, going back to Ronald Judy, he describes that the Negro who was literate in Arabic, however, flew in the face of the received conception of the Negro of Africa as a subhuman brute or subspecies of human, and laid claim to a degree of culture thought to be the privileged property of modern Europe. So both texts, fictional and non-fictional, establish is that while Omar and Mustafa may be enslaved physically, both spiritually and mentally, each was free of his captor's shackles. Omar's autobiography begins with a surah or chapter from the Quran called Al-Mulk, which literally means power and ownership, creating the perfect allusion to slavery. The surah contends that it is God who is the owner of all and everything. Through his choice of this particular chapter in the Quran, Omar seems to refute the right of his owners over him, since only God has the mulk, the power, and the ownership, according to a scholar Al-Rayes, who translated Omar bin Said's autobiography. And so in this way, Omar frames his writing, the story of his life and capture, with a rejection of the very notion that one human can possibly own another. His use of the Quran to frame his autobiography is symbolic of the persistent centrality of his Muslim faith to his identity, however hidden its expression may be under the circumstances of his enslavement. We see a similar reference to the institution of slavery that he was victim to and a resistance to it in the Moor's account. Mustafa repeats his full name again and again and as an affirmation of his being, and he frequently refers to himself as the servant of God, Mustafa ibn Muhammad, and always the servant of God, Mustafa ibn Muhammad, reminding his readers and himself, much as Omar ibn Said does, that despite his physical enslavement, his servitude is to God alone. When he sells himself into slavery in order to save his family from impoverishment, the clerk requests his name, and he responds, Mustafa ibn Muhammad ibn Abd al-Salam al-Zamuri, I replied, naming myself, my father, my grandfather, and my native town. With deliberately slow movements, the clerk opened his register and dipped his feather into black ink, and he wrote, Mustafa, 15 rays. Thus, he describes the mundanity and ruthless ease with which his erasure takes place. He traded what should never be traded. It delivered him into the unknown and erased his father's name. And he says, he continues to say, I could not know that this was just the first of many erasures. Later, when he's given the Christian name Esteban, he describes himself as being converted and orphaned in one gesture. The erasure of his name signifies the erasure of history and his being. His writing becomes an attempt to restore both. In the clutches of captivity and its erasure, Diouf remarks that African Muslim slaves remained attached to their faith, and their enslavement was itself a good reason to be even more devout. Resorting to prayer as a means of strength and self-preservation is no surprise, but of particular interest is the repercussions of the visible signs of faith that we see both in Mustafa's account and in earlier accounts. So Mustafa says, I tried to seek comfort in prayer and to speak to my maker in the only way I knew. This is on page 116. Once I was prostrated behind the counter in the shop, facing east toward Mecca for the Asr prayer, begging the Lord to save me. Help me find a way home, I whispered. Help me, O merciful God. The sudden weight of a Spanish boot upon my neck silenced my voice. And the next moment, my face, scraping against the brick floor of the shop, was smashed against a pot from Malaga. The beatings repeated themselves with such a wearying frequency that I desisted from praying and retreated instead into silent communions with my Lord. This scene recalls a similar telling from some memoirs from the life of Job bin Solomon, where he says, where he's described as often he would leave the cattle and withdraw into the woods to pray. But then a white boy frequently watched, and while he was at his devotion, this boy would mock him and throw dirt in his face. This very much disturbed Job and added to his other misfortunes. And so in that way, again, we see a parallel between what's happening in the Moor's account and in ways that it's kind of referencing back and echoing these scenes from earlier non-fictional slave writings. The return to faith in moments of hardship is again highlighted when Mustafa describes the fear he and his fellow survivors lived in as their numbers were dwindling due to fever, native attacks, and hunger. And he writes, sometimes I thought of letting go. I wondered what would happen to me if I was infected with the fever and perished in this land. In this moment of desperation, hopelessness, and loneliness, he recites a verse from the Quran and traces it in the sand. I whispered Ayat al-Kursi, a specific verse from the Quran, to myself over and over, the way I had as a child. Whenever I had been scared or troubled or worried, hoping it would grant me the same measure of peace it had back then. With a stick in my hand, I wrote the verse on the ground before me, each word, each stroke, taking me back further to my days at the Masjid in Azamour, to those days when my life was still my own. The practice of sand writing is a traditional African teaching practice used with children, the first step in preserving one's literacy, according to Sylvain Diouf. In this moment, the Quran and his faith are a sort of source of solace and comfort. As Diouf states, faith meant hope, moral comfort, and mental escape. It was also a link to the past, to a time when they were free, respected, and for some, engaged in intellectual pursuits, not menial labor. This powerful moment again mirrors an identical habit undertaken by Abdurrahman Ibrahim ibn Suri, who also there's a popular documentary, if you've heard of it, called The Prince Among Slaves, which is also the title of the biography written by Terry Alford. So he lived between 1762 and 1829, and he was a prince from West Africa who was enslaved for 40 years before he eventually gained his freedom in a series of events that revolved around his literacy. So basically, when it was found that he could read and write, this gained him a lot of popularity, and then his bearing and his previous status as prince kind of gained him popularity, and he became a celebrity of sorts. Ellen Austin refers to him as the most famous African in America in 1828. So again, going back to the scene where Mustafa is writing in the sand, and we have a similar scene where Ibrahima, this individual, had no access to pen and paper. Alford writes, he had no Quran, years became decades, and he did not see a single Islamic text or piece of Arabic writing. To retain his own literacy, he took to tracing Arabic characters in the sand when Thomas would call a rest during work. In emerging of the historical and the fictional, again, looking at Omar bin Said as an example, Jab bin Salman, and then Ibrahim Abdurrahman. So looking at all of these examples and bringing that together with Mustafa's own, Sabanico or Mustafa helps us to arrive at a deeper, more human understanding of all of these individuals' experiences and the experience of Muslim slaves from the past. Beyond preserving their literacy, all of these men were engaged in a preservation of their memories, their faith, and their spiritual and mental strength that would allow them to survive the trials of their enslavement. Thank you.